Night and all day. My name is Ted Oenby. I'm at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, and I'm gonna sit down among friends. 20 feet from stardom was about our distance from Bill Malone, so that's all fitting as well. And we've developed a policy of no more than two sentences of thanks. But let me give my two sentences of thanks to the Filson Society, to Mark, to Judy, to Scott, and the whole staff of the Filson Society. I was trying to remember why I had such a warm feeling for the Filson Society, and it went back a long time. And the Filson Society's journal published my first book review back when I was 15 or something. And so, thank you. Thanks especially to Estelle Buck Pennington, who suggested the theme for this conference. Broadly thanking the city of Louisville and all of you for coming, specifically thanking Emily Bingham for her help, and thanks also, along with Buck Pennington, to their other speakers, Bill Malone and Celeste Ray and our colleague John T. Edge, and again, thanks to all of you for being here, and I think that's maybe two and a half sentences. I should mention what we're here for a little while to do is to think about the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture series, the 24-volume series that completed this year. Should mention before then that if you are so excited by one volume or all 24, that they are all available for purchase. In different ways, of course, at the University of North Carolina Press, our publisher has the whole series and individually as them available, the series on with quite a nice bargain for those of you who are 24-volume book buyers. University of North Carolina Press, the Center for the Study of Southern Culture's website has a link directly to that and ways to do that. And some of us know that one can buy books in bookstores as well, so that's an option. And certain online booksellers that those bookstores would prefer that we not mention, so we will not. But again, thanks for being here. These are all colleagues. These are people I work with and have worked with for years, and some of them with great respect and my best friends in the world. And Ann Abadie to my left is the center's founding associate director and was the associate director until a couple of years ago, and is now the semi-retired associate director of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture. Associate editor of both the original Encyclopedia of Southern Culture in 1989 and the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture series. Jimmy Thomas, among many other things, is a graduate, an MA graduate of the Southern Studies program, which is part of my job, is to mention that whenever I possibly can. And Jimmy is now associate director for publications at the center, and is managing editor of all 24 volumes. A secret between us, 23 of the 24 volumes came out on time, and a secret among the four of us, we're not telling you what the late one was. And Charles Reagan Wilson, you know, if you were here last night, is a professor of history and Southern studies, co-editor of the original Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, and the general editor of the 24-volume series, and the volume editor of History volume and the Myth, Manners, and Memory volume. And all three of my colleagues have been involved in every word, almost every word, probably every word, and every of the however many pages it takes to put out a 24-volume series. When we talk generally about 24-volume series, our friend Richard Howarth at Square Books in Oxford mentioned it's the only 24-volume series that he would even consider putting in a bookstore, and we were trying to think of other 24-volume series books, and there was a day when encyclopedia salesman knocked on your door and said, but they didn't carry them, they carried one, and then they said they'd mail them to you, and we're here my job is to ask some obvious questions and maybe a couple of not quite so obvious questions and open the floor for your questions, either about the content, things discussed already, things we haven't discussed, about the process, how do you do this, how do you decide, But I'll start with Charles Wilson and the basic and most obvious question: why? Why in the world a 24-volume series to New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture?
Why not?
Well, okay, fine. Question two. Sorry, that's all.
I came to the University of Mississippi in 1981 to work on the original Encyclopedia of Southern Culture with our colleague Bill Ferris and Than and Sue Hart and others. And so we did this book that came out in 1989, made a nice impact, and the country was interested in the South. And so there was a fascination with the South that I think you saw in the book being widely reviewed and in all sorts of formats. So we did the encyclopedia. I went back to teaching. And people periodically would ask me, well, when are you going to do another edition? And I would say, the one thing I learned from doing an encyclopedia is never to do an encyclopedia. It's with you all the time and a very collaborative act, so you're dependent on other people getting their articles in on time, right, Jimmy? And so, but the logic of the new a new encyclopedia became apparent around the turn of the 21st century, the theme that I talked about last night, and partly because there were so many changes in the South and so many changes in the study of the South. Now, from 1989, a little over a decade, was not a long period of time historically, but that was an extraordinary period of change, and we did use the term global in the original encyclopedia, but not much, not the way it became used in the late 1990s and in the 21st century. So urbanization, suburbanization, political changes, new forms of culture, rap music burst on the scene, not in the original Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. Now, I may have, when you talked about the Dirty South originally, it was probably about junkyards, but Dirty South is a form of music, the Dirty South, a famous genre. New forms of literature kind of took off, much more writing by women, African Americans building on the literary tradition coming out of the South, gay and lesbian literature, white working class literature, something that has not been studied enough at all. So these were things needing to be studied. There was beginning to be new scholarship on these things, and so you think about the encyclopedia. If it's going to be a living thing in a sense, it needs to grow. And we thought about it originally as just a kind of second edition, but this idea of doing separate volumes, it was a way to expand the whole thing, giving us more space, more room to cover each topic in the depth that it needed to be done. So I think a combination of the changes in the South, the changes of the study of the South really led us to do this.
The immediately related question is, If you and Ann who are involved in, I'm mic'd. Thank you. I live part of my life mic'd now. I never expected to do that, but I kind of like it. And the related question is what's new about it? Not just how much, but the new volumes, the new approaches, and whether that. Ann or Jimmy, if you want to start with, as Charles said, it took the original sections, turned those into single volumes, or sometimes paired them, and then had a number of brand new things. But if you could talk about what's new a little bit.
Well, we have new divisions. We have the old, but in the 1989 version, we had women's life. Right. Now we have gender, which includes everybody and everything, and a lovely drawing by Walter Anderson of Ocean Springs, Mississippi. And we had black life in the first volume, but now it's race, and then partly in the ethnicity volume, too. And so it really permeates. It goes through the whole instead of just separate. And so those are the new sections. But with the original volume, 1,600 and so pages, this thick, hard to pick up and read, and it's nice to pick this up. And we found out that people were using the original encyclopedia in class, But they were either taking the big volume and trying to put it on a copying machine, or they were tearing out pages to copy, say, the section on literature to use in their classes. And so this makes it easier. You can get a student to buy one 1998 volume for class instead of a $69 volume. And then Charles and Ted and Jimmy don't like to hear me say this, but we can keep the new encyclopedia up to date, so that when we have more to say about gender, all we have to do is pick out one volume and go with it. And my prediction is that the first volume that will need a revision is The Art and Architecture, because we had a hard time putting it into one. It's a one fat volume, and we had to leave out so much that we need to put out the old and the new that we didn't, the old that we didn't have and the new that isn't there, and have the two volume. And a lot of these volumes are used in class, and they're good to read, and you can do that easily.
Although, as regards the Art and Architecture volume, part of that, which I think is interesting from an academic standpoint, is the fact that the one artistic aspect of the South that had been extensively studied since the colonial revival era was our architectural heritage. And so that there was actually far more earlier writing on architecture than there were on the early painters. And it was a tradition actually also fostered by the first serious art history program in this country, which was at Princeton, to include art and architecture together as a study. And that precedes the days when architecture now has really as much to do with, as I said in my remarks, about socioeconomics and environmental impact as with style. So it would be nice to split them up. And it would also be nice, now don't whack me, but it would also be nice to sort through the so-called folk artists and perhaps have art and architecture.
Well, and another part of that volume that we put in at the end, I've complained a whole lot, because when I retired, I said, people said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to cultivate my garden, having two black thumbs that they haven't even turned brown yet. But I am interested in gardens, and we didn't have anything on gardens. There was something maybe in the agriculture volume, if you really looked hard, somebody's mother had flowers or so, or grandmother liked Rose of Sharon or that kind of rose. But so we have one nice article on gardens that Judith Bonner, the co-editor of Art and Architecture, had done, and we held the press to get that in, and we need to say a lot more about gardens. So that's something new that has not really been covered very thoroughly there. So what are we going to do with that, with the encyclopedia? I mean, we know that, but I mean, you want to let them do the garden book? Okay.
Jimmy Thomas, I should mention, along with being the managing editor of all 24 volumes, is the volume editor of Science and Medicine. But we should mention also, and so my question to Jimmy is going to be, how does this work? How does one put together a 24-volume process? But along with women's life to gender, black life to race, brand new volumes, foodways, folk art, and Charles added the word memory to the, which was interesting. That myth, manners, and memory was there, and memory was not in the first mm-hmm. part of, and some other reconfigurations along the way, But Jimmy came to us, well, many years ago now. This process has gone on quite some time. How would you quickly describe the challenge of putting together 24 books?
How do you put together a 24-volume encyclopedia? It's kind of like that old saying, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. With this volume, it took over 1,500 contributors to write the over 3,000 entries in the entire series. I was personally in touch with nearly all of those 1,500 contributors. So that it's a 10-year project shouldn't come as any surprise. The volumes were staggered. We published the first two or three in 2006, and the 23rd and 24th volumes were published this past May. I was very fortunate in that a lot of people wanted to work on this project. We got the best scholars from across the nation. Cases from across the world. One of our volume editors was teaches at the University of Nottingham. So she got a number of contributors for the media volume from Great Britain, which has a long and established relationship with American studies. We got folks like Bill Malone and Buck Pennington, Celeste Ray, and of course John T. Edge to work on developing the content. We had from the original volumes an idea of what was going into these books, but then I would have conversations with Buck and Celeste and Bill and what needed to go into these new books. When we originally started thinking about creating this new series, we thought 20-30%. New material and update the original material. We found quickly was not going to be the case. As Celeste mentioned, we went from, 30-something to 80-something ethnic groups, and we could have added more. Getting in touch with those scholars who are the people working in these fields, figuring out not just, for example, the ethnic group to focus on, but different aspects of, say, ethnicity, different aspects of music, race and music. Who is doing study? Who is doing work on race and music? Who is doing studies on, say, if we look at the gender volume, and Ted Owenby is modest. Ted Owenby was co-volume editor of this gender volume.
Or forgetful, perhaps.
If we look at this gender volume, we'll see that we've got articles on things like suffrage and anti-suffrage, bells and ladies, beauty shops and barber shops. Charles wrote that article. Good old boys and girls, politics, women in, 1700s to 1920. So we figured... We looked at the literature that was out there and determined who was writing interesting things and who would be willing to write smaller articles on based on their own work, and a lot of people were willing to do that.
Jimmy didn't mention that one of his jobs was to find illustrations. We had some pictures and graphs in the first volume, but we wanted to have more, and that was one of his jobs, and so he came up with lovely illustrations for covers and the insides, and also... marvelous photographs. What do you do? How do you illustrate violence? Well, without being too violent in doing it. And Jimmy did a good job. You want to talk about finding the images and working on that? I think they could.
Sure. One of our great sources was the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress has a very large digital archive that those images are in the public domain. Worked with them. Worked with various holdings of fine art, various holdings of self-taught art, various holdings of studio images that may be film stills. Coming up with images for these books is no easy task, really, primarily because our budget was not enormous. So we couldn't go to some of these stock image holdings and buy $500 images to fill 24 volumes. It's just not possible. So we had to get creative, but we would write people who we thought would have images, and it worked out incredibly well. of course, the images from Buck's book. Buck, you'll tell me. I recognize so many of the images on these walls, but I'm very familiar with all of your books. And I know that Lessons in Likeness contains images from these walls. Before the Art and Architecture volume, which images came from the Filson?
What I mainly did, this comes back to the budgetary issue, was to appeal to private individuals and to museums I knew who would give me images. So we had images from Matt Cox, that's what may seem familiar from here, from Kentucky Portraiture, from the Morris Museum of Art, from the Johnson Collection. I think we had some things from the Speed, but with my volume, obviously it's extremely important to have illustrations. But we could hardly illustrate more than 100 artists and more than, probably far more than that in terms of buildings. But we do have the basic information, but obviously cost is a factor. Art books are extremely expensive to publish, as we all know. And the future of the art book is something that's very much a hot topic of conversation, because much as I hate to admit it, you would be able to get such a good image in a, whatever they call those things, a walkie-talkie book for you.
One of the major differences between Art and Architecture and the Folk Art volume is that those two volumes, since they are art volumes, have color inserts. So we just felt that we couldn't have art books with just black and white images. So there are color inserts, each of 16 leaves, which is 32 pages, leaves. We were fortunate. And Buck was instrumental in making sure that that happened. And thank you very much for that.
I escaped with my life because my precious Charles did allow me to review the folk art list. And I said, you may absolutely not have my Annabelle Portrait Painters as folk artists, because we don't have that tradition. Okay, we're going to use Matthew Harris Jr. as a folk artist. Yeah. I don't think so.
Our editor's job, our general editor's job, is getting apparently harder all the time. But let me ask just two more questions, and then open up for questions from the floor. One, Center for the Study of Southern Culture. It starts with teaching our students, and we have a BA program, MA program. We learn from students frequently what matters and what. And one of the questions that we ask a lot and have discussions about is the relationship between what you study and what you love. Do you study what you love most, or how do you study something that you're so passionate about? And do you study what's a problem, on the other hand? Charles, is there an easy way to answer about the relationship between kind of loving parts of this and studying things that we don't love and things that are beyond issues of love and hate?
Ooh, what a question. It's a good question. And I think all of us who study the South in one way deal with it in different ways, probably. I mean, I think for some scholars of the South, it's just a business, probably, you know. And I'm a scholar, so I'm always looking to be objective and find out what are the relevant questions in the scholarship now, what is the historiography, how can I advance that knowledge. But, you know, I chose to study the South. I grew up in the South. You know, my grandparents lived in Robertson County, Tennessee, so Ted and I are driving up yesterday, and I get nostalgic looking at scenes around there in the tobacco country. My dad grew up on a tobacco farm. And so, you know, I'm studying, you know, I'm not studying German history, you know. And so there's that level somehow of engagement, you know, in it. I think in the new encyclopedia, it's, for me personally, it's you know, I wrote a lot of articles, because when you're an encyclopedia editor and you decide there's an important topic, and if you can't find someone who has done the work on it, you know, or the classic work has been done, but that person's moved on to something else. Well, what do you do? If it's an important topic, you think, or it's an interesting topic, you wind up doing a lot of these kind of things. Anyway, a lot of them I just did because they needed to be done. But I did things that, looking back, were kind of interesting to me, that you know, biscuits. I wrote the article in John T. Edge's book on biscuits, you know? And so I got stuff from music, you know, and from literature, and studied cookbooks, you know. And so that was fun. You know, that was the fun part of it. And that, I think, reflected something about my engagement with that aspect of the South. And thinking back as I wrote that about my grandmother making biscuits, that kind of thing. You know, just kind of things that pop through your head. I wrote the article on, well, barbershops and beauty shops. I mean, my gosh, you know, I go to a hair salon now, you know.
But, and it's utterly obvious.
Yes. They don't have much to work with anymore. But you know, barbershops and beauty shops resonate, you know, with my kind of conception of the South, whatever. I wrote an article that's probably my favorite called Passing the Time in the South. You know, we had all these entries in the Sports and Recreation volume on all these different activities, but I was reading through the list and the text, and this is very toward the end of putting together the volume. I thought, well, there's something Southerners do that is not covered, and that's passing the time. And I found this Harris poll that asked Southerners what they do, you know, and in terms of activities, go to concerts, you know, do sports, do whatever, whole list. And it turns out Southerners, the thing they say the most they like to do is just hang out, you know, and pass the time. And anyway, so I think, you know, it's a mix for me, you know, my scholarship is kind of the focus on religion in the South, you know, and so I came out of a conservative religious tradition, church when I was growing up, got away from that, but about, like a lot of people in religious studies, we come out of those kind of church backgrounds. You may get away from it, but you take religion seriously and think about it in terms of culture and society and want to study it and think about it. And it's that way with me in the South, in a sense, you know. And all of us have very complex identities in the modern world. We think of ourselves in a lot of different ways. And Southerner, I think this is very common for Southerners. Now, it may not be our only identity anymore, you know, but it's one of many identities, perhaps. But it's still there, I think, for scholars probably as well as for others.
I've got a bunch of questions, but they're less interesting than those that you would ask. So questions? Yes, sir.
Well, can you give us an example or two of a notorious example or two of articles that have been submitted?
No.
Regarded as inappropriate or not particularly.
Boy, let me go back to my questions here. First, we asked for. I mean, there's very seldom that people submitted things that were not solicited. Is that right?
So we commissioned the articles. So basically, we know what we're dealing with. We know these are people who've written about this topic before, or have some reason to think they're going to do it. Now, we got articles. This is the classic thing about scholars that I didn't realize before I became an editor, is they often pay no attention to the parameters of what you want them to do. They're too long, you know. They're not focused on the right aspect of this topic, you know. So that's what editors do, you know, and so all of this. Now, this is not related to that, sir, but this is my favorite story of working with a contributor. And this was in the original encyclopedia. And there was, we had this huge list of topics. And I sent the list to a friend of mine and asking for anything we'd missed. And he said, Charles, out of all this, there's nothing on sex. So I said, yes, we need something on sex. And sex in the South. What a topic. This will be great. And I had this imagined, you know, it'd be partly kind of a, you know, Kinsey South report. You know, look at statistics, you know, and all this secondary analysis. And it'll be partly kind of a Tennessee Williams, you know, steamy South and all this. So I think, well, who to do this? Well, we thought of Florence King. Now, Florence King is a humorist and did this wonderful book, Southern Ladies and Gentlemen. And so, you know, and this is one where I have to say, this would have been one that she probably would have done something inappropriate. But we wrote her a letter. She wrote a nice letter back saying, thank you. It turns out she had been a student at the University of Mississippi. She said, I would love to do something for Ole Miss, but I can't. I'm tired of writing about sex, you know, and all this. And she went on and on, you know, and the overheated imagination of the American public. That's the only reason writers write about sex. I wish I could take the collective libido of the American people and chop it off. So Anne's going to add the aftermath to that.
It wasn't really a very nice letter. Charles is too nice to say that. But a few years later, she wrote me about something else, and she said, I really am sorry that I wrote that letter the way I did. She said, I was just going through the menopause and couldn't help it.
We haven't mentioned that we're just about to send off to the press a Mississippi encyclopedia. It's called the Mississippi Encyclopedia, and largely the same process as the original, but taking a number of leading scholars who sent us lists, and then finding people to write those. And our myths and representations section editor sent a nice long list. And Mississippi, you can imagine, is particularly intense, loving and hating its myths and representations. And down at the bottom, kind of a different type, but there was one called a potential entry called Habit of Turning Psychopathologies into Eccentricities. And I wrote back and said, I don't even know how to alphabetize that. And he wrote back and said, sorry about that. That was from my last visit to my in-laws. So that will make its way in there, but not as an entry. Other questions about? Yes. Yes, Laura.
I'm curious about sort of new frontiers in Southern study scholarship, and where do you see the 25th volume being?
Oh.
Ooh.
We don't need any more numbers.
No more numbers. No more numbers. God, I don't know. I don't know. I think it would have to be probably something on the kind of south in the world, you know, and just develop more. There's a lot on globalization that runs through it all, but there's much more that could be done with that. And I suspect if we were to do it 20 years from now, there'd be enough new scholarship that would be the kind of frontier, the south and the Caribbean, the south and Europe, the south and Asia, and connections of musical genres, connections of, you know, I've got this one graduate student that I'm on a dissertation committee that's doing a study of Pentecostal literature in the South and in Africa. It turns out their Pentecostals have been in Africa, and they're writers that coming out of this tradition. And so, you know, that's hardly known now. This student is doing something really original with research. So it's opening up all sorts of things. And so I think we'll have more studies that kind of try to figure out, you know, if the economics and are connecting us, the South, to the world in new ways, then our culture keeps up with that. You know, we find out ideas that are flowing in new and different and interesting ways, and music and literature and art and all of this. You know, and it's fascinating to think in the South about the coming of all of these immigrants that we talk about, how this will change music, for example. I mean, we should get Bill Malone to think about this, you know, with Vietnamese in the South Louisiana coast. You know, what kind of musical fusions and creolization, Celeste, will happen with those young Vietnamese growing up here listening to Cajun music? My God, think of the possibilities. But I think that's, you know, we see it happening in food. John Tees talked about this, and Celeste also. And, you know, probably that's maybe the quickest way it happens. It may take things like music and literature a little longer, but I think that would be likely the next volume.
Yes, sir.
Has there been any work done on the involvement of military organizations in the South, particularly the weather that makes flight training on a year-round basis? You're better here than you are in Vermont. And the other activities of the military organizations.
I think this is a hugely understudied topic about the military in the South. I mean, it's just when you think about the role of, and we have articles on the military tradition, and on military bases, and I think those are just totally understudied by scholars. The importance economically of military bases, for example, the history of them, how they got to the South. The relationship of the South and the federal government as seen through military bases, the role of science and technology that military bases, you know, in Mississippi, the Stennis Center down on the coast is a hugely important innovator in terms of science and technology. And throughout the South, this is true. And you know, the role of the climate, exactly. You know, why in many cases those bases came to the South in the first place is because of year-round training that's possible. The effect, you know, going back to the desegregation of the military and how that was accomplished, you know, because the military is the military, you know, the discipline and the order once the decision is made, this, you know, that's an amazing story of how that happened. And very few people even think about this. You know, when we have huge amount of literature on civil rights and integration, that could be the most cutting edge of the new scholarship if anybody ever took it seriously. Excuse me, you touched into something that I think is very important, and so I think that's, you know, we tried to open it up through those articles, though.
The Naval Air Station in Meridian, Mississippi.
Yeah.
That's one of the things you're going to explain in the future.
Yes.
Well, they'll have more to say, but that's something that we considered a little bit. But I really think that is indeed, in addition to Garden, something that will require that we have a two-volume, one volume of the art and architecture, that we separate that. I don't know if we'll call it number 16 A and B or what, maybe Buck or you, Charles, would like to add more to that.
Well, here's what would have to happen. I'm already concerned about duplication of interest. I'm already concerned that the Circle for Southern Intellectual History is having a lecture on regionalism and national art. So I think we really have to coordinate that with the Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I think that, well, it does, and referring to us as backcountry, but the cabinet-making tradition, the silversmithing tradition, Jessie touched a little bit on that with her book on Louisiana armoires. we do need, you know, more of that, more of the decorative arts traditions, which we just didn't have the space for all of that. And it's an extremely important part of our heritage, because every state in the South has wonderful furniture and silver traditions.
And soft goods. As soft goods people, the furniture people, there are a lot of books. And most of them are great, but I think. I just wondered as I perused through.
The textiles.
Yeah. And one of the points of perusing through is that sometimes the same topics are considered in different volumes by different people. And so you'll find something in gender and in social class that you may find done in a different way in a more specific thematic art book. Sometimes even surprisingly so.
I think there are figures like Bessie Smith who could have shown up in music, in women's life, and black race, and so that's an important kind of figure that crosses all those boundaries. So.
Jimmy? Well, actually, we outsourced the indexing. At first I thought I was going to have to do it, and I wasn't going to be there long. Indexing is tedious work. So we did hire freelancers who were suggested initially from the University of North Carolina Press to do those volumes. They're very well done. There's not, and to be honest, that might be volume 25 if there ever is one. It's just a comprehensive index for all. And that's something we have talked about, and I think it's something that would be very helpful.
I'll mention something about the first volume. We had a very extensive index. I don't remember the numbers now, but we probably had 150 pages of the index, and it was a huge volume. And they said we had to cut it, so we cut it down to about 60 TypeScript pages. And so there are a lot of things that are in that first volume that you couldn't prove by going, or couldn't find by going to the index, because we had to cut so severely there. So I think maybe an index volume by itself would be good too.
Yeah, no, indices should live on full indexes should live on online.
Yeah.
And the books themselves don't need to be online. That doesn't work, but it doesn't work so well. But an index, a general index put together, maybe a graduate assistant would be.
Yeah, that's a graduate assistant project for several years.
One last question, and then we're done. And thank you all, and no pressure on your question. But we will answer it in a celebratory sort of way, no matter what it is.
Of course, I think everybody here is very proud about being Southern, and I'm sure your books, your encyclopedias, celebrate that. However, do they also address the problems that we have, and how we're going to continue to be a viable society and address our problems? Because we do have many on every volume, every part of our life has problems, and I think it doesn't do much good to celebrate being Southern if we also don't address our problems.
Yeah. First of all, I'm not particularly proud of being a Southerner. That's not important to me. But that's I study the South. That's what I did, as opposed to celebrating in my own life. And I suspect that if there's a kind of contemporary reality that 20 years from now they'll say, why wasn't it the dominating issue for our scholarship? A lot of people would say this. It's the percentage of people in prison today. It's the kind of thing that people look back and say, why weren't they all thinking about slavery? Or why weren't they all thinking about segregation? And that may be the question. We certainly address some of the issues. Some of the volumes are very much problem driven, and some of them are not so clearly, but not so much solution driven as much as the discussion of problems and where they might come from. What is that?
Yeah, definitely. I want to reinforce that to you. This is not a book, a series of simply celebrating the South at all. I mean, we're very hard minded about the South's problems, and there's some. You know, we have a whole volume on violence, for example. If you look at the urbanization volume, it's all about the problems of cities. It's not a celebration of cities, even though the cities have their own distinctive character and great qualities. A lot of it is the realities of southern cities are there some real problems with science and medicine. You know, despite the South, the fact that the South's health indices are better than they would have been 100 years ago, there are serious problems with obesity, high HIV, AIDS rates, poverty. You know, rural poverty is higher in the South than anywhere in the country, and that generates health problems. So these volumes engage very seriously the problems of the South as well, and try to give some perspective on them, you know, in terms of the history of those science and medicine problems that persist. You know, they're not new outgrowths. They're often deeply rooted and hard to overcome. So,
and sometimes when there's celebration, it is celebrating people addressing them. So it is the interaction of the problem with somebody's attempt successfully, half successfully, not successfully yet, to address them, and that becomes part of what the fascination of Southern culture is. But that's actually a wonderful ending question. So we appreciate it. But thank you all again for being here. And
so thanks so much for joining us, you and the audience. I think that Ted did a great job of thanking the Filson team, and Scott, and everyone involved on the programming side, and for acknowledging ESSEL's role in bringing this idea to us. But I really want to thank the center at Ole Miss for their willingness to come here, to bring their group, their team, and their editors, and making this possible. Because without that willingness, we would not have had this institute. So please join me in giving all of our thanks. course, we're looking forward to the Bourbon County driving tour, which actually drives part of the trip is down Cane Ridge Road, which Bill Malone mentioned in our final lecture there. And if you want to get more details or sign up, see Judy Miller at the back of the room. And also, if you want to join as a member, this is the shameless commerce part, see Sarah Strapp. She's at the back of the room, and she'll be happy to sign you up. If you want to listen to some of the programs again or recommend them to another person, if you're a member, you can listen to some of these programs as podcast or telecast on the website. So thank you very much again, and we'll adjourn.
Great.